Well, it's a dirty fact, but everybody knows that the Miss World Beauty Pageant is a notoriously ugly business. It began in 1951 in the United Kingdom, and at that stage it was really very little more than a meat market. Then in the 1980s, the crudeness of ogling women would, and then rewarding them for nothing other than their physique and their prettiness was nuanced to include other criteria of intelligence and personality, congeniality, that type of thing. The pageant has also been marked with drama and politics and trouble over the decades. In 1970, that year, the feminists bombarded the stage with flower bombs to kind of make a protest against the meat market of it all. In 1973, the winner, Marjorie Wallace, was dethroned and defrocked and dismissed because she was seen kissing singer Tom Jones while being engaged to somebody who was not singer Tom Jones. She was fired. The next year, Helen Morgan resigned when she was outed as a, wait for it, a mother. They don't call it Mrs. World. It's called Miss World. Her crown went to South African Annelien Kriel. So there was a happy ending to that story anyway. In 1980, the German winner resigned a day after winning because her boyfriend approved. Now, this is interesting because the boyfriend disapproved of her winning Miss World because she would be on tour without him for a year. He didn't have any problems with her entering the competition, which goes to show he just didn't think that she had any chance of winning. So when she won, that's when he disapproved. The pageant also has political ramifications, as it did in 1976. South Africa, in keeping with its delusion that apartheid was normal, sent two delegates to the competition, one white lady and one black lady, and that sparked a boycott from many countries, although people were unclear if they were protesting against the apartheid or if they were boycotting it because they weren't allowed to send two people to compete. Nobody really knows. In 2002, the competition was being held in a Muslim country, in Nigeria, and it got very political when Miss Norway, Catherine Sorland, began a revolt among the delegates, talking many of them into joining her revolt, where they refused to go on stage, they refused to perform. So she actually changed her mind and ended up being a semi-finalist when a whole of the others had quit. So I don't know, that was just a coincidence. But anyway, she whittled out the field a little bit there. But the drama didn't end there. A journalist made a comment in this Muslim country that if Muhammad were alive, he would probably have picked one of his many wives from the delegates. Now, the writer meant that as a compliment to the ladies, that they were so beautiful. But of course, the Muslim population there took it as an offensive comment, and they began rioting, not because Muhammad was called a polygamist, they had no problem with that, but because the insinuation that he would choose a wife who was seen in public in a swimsuit. Anyway, that carried on going. That year, ironically, that year's winner was Miss Turkey, the first ever winner chosen from a Muslim country. I don't know if that was a coincidence either. Politics and pageantry often go hand in glove, as was seen from the very first Miss World pageant in the history of the world, which we see in Esther chapter 2. So turn your Bibles to the book of Esther. This is the description of the first Miss World competition. Now, if you haven't been with us the past few weeks, have been going through this, let me just remind you of the context, because it's important to understand that. This book takes place during the Babylonian captivity. It's actually after the 70-year Babylonian captivity. It's mostly after Ezra and before Nehemiah. That's where the timeline fits in. Geographically, it does not happen in the land of Israel. It happens outside of Israel, where the Jews had been exiled. The Babylonians had been conquered by the Medo-Persians. And so now this is happening in that stage of history, in that place, in the capital city of Medo-Persia called Susa. That's where this is happening. That's important to know. Last time we were in the text, we met King Ahasuerus, or if you're reading secular history, they often call him by his much cooler sounding Greek name, Xerxes. And we saw that Xerxes got bored with being the wealthiest, most secure, most feared, most worshipped man on earth, and so he decided to throw a party of epic proportions. He invited every major politician in his vast empire to come to his palace, and there was an open bar, all you can eat. There were ladies there. They were the type of ladies that were not hired for their administrative abilities, if you know what I mean. And the men's wives were kept separate in a different palace with Queen Vashti overseeing their festivities. Now, after 180 days, about a half a year of drunken debauchery, the sozzled king sends a messenger to call his beautiful wife to come and parade her in front of his dinner guests like a piece of meat. And Queen Vashti says something that no one had ever been brave enough to do since the Spartan warriors of Thermopylae. She said, no. She said, no, I'm not coming. And nobody really knew what to do with that. We'll kind of pick up the story from there. He calls his advisors, and he says, what do I do? I don't know. I don't have a category for someone saying no to me. Usually I would just kill the person, but it's my wife. What do we do? And the advisors say, listen, you've got to do something. I know you can't kill her, but man, if you just let this go unpunished, you've just created a new world where men will have to get their own coffee and make their own dinners. And we can't have that because we've just created a world where women can say no to men. You got to fix this. So you need to banish her. And that's exactly what he did. He banished her to a life of luxury in the palace that she may never see him again, which is really winning first prize if you've met this guy. But this is what happens. Now, we know what's happening here is that God is like a grandmaster in chess, moving his kings and his queens into position, and he's moving a little pawn that we're going to meet tonight into position that she can one day be promoted to be a queen in order to work out his great plan of preservation of the Jews. And so we're going to see three evidences of God's involvement in making beauty out of ugliness. I've entitled this sermon, Why Bad Things Happen to Good Beauty Queens. And we really do see this rendition of Beauty and the Beast being played out here with these three evidences of God's involvement in making beauty out of ugliness. The first evidence is the effects of a painful curse. We'll see the efforts of a protective custody, and finally the efficacy of a planned course. So firstly, the effects of a painful curse. We see this. Let me read for you the first 18 verses of chapter 2. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's attendants who served him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of the kingdoms, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, into the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti." And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives, and who had been exiled with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. He was bringing up, or raising, Hadassah, that is Esther. So Hadassah is her Hebrew name. Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. So this is his cousin that he's raising, Hadassah. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it came about, when the command and the decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered into the citadel of Susa, into the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken into the king's palace into the custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the woman. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him. So he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and food and gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. And Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. In other words, she didn't tell anyone that she was Jewish. Every day, Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. Now, when the turn of each young lady came to go into the king Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women, for the days of their beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women. I mean, you think it takes your wife a long time to put on the makeup. This takes a year for these ladies to get ready to see the king. Verse 13, the young lady would go into the king in this way, and anything that she desired was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not again go into the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So there's, you know, quarterfinals and semifinals and then finals. Now, when the turn of Esther, verse 15, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king, she did not request anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. When the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther did not. Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. So stop there. That's as far as we'll get. Little Hadassah is born in captivity. Her family was captured and deported by the Babylonians. They shuffled along to the Medo-Persians. She's orphaned during this. Her parents die during the captivity. This poor little girl is a victim of horrific circumstances completely out of her control. She's trapped. She's trapped in a life that none of us would wish upon the daughter of our worst enemy. Captured, deported, orphaned, growing up in this type of society. She gets singled out because of her beauty. It doesn't seem that the women have any say in this at all. They're just preyed upon by the men, by this king. And she's a victim to all of this, and there's really nothing she can do about it. And a question that might brew in our minds is, why? Why? I mean, when you study the news, when you see what's going on in the world and all the human trafficking and the suffering and the genocide and the corruption and all that type of stuff that we're going to see in this book, sometimes we just ask, well, why? Why is God letting this happen? Where is God in all of this? And it's not a question that's limited to Christians. Non-Christians ask this too. In fact, when Rabbi Krishna wrote his famous book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People, he surmised that, well, basically, bad things, when they happen, you shouldn't blame God. You should sympathize with him because God is as surprised at what's happening as you are. God wasn't able to stop that. Don't blame him. Commiserate with him. And that'll make you feel better. I mean, to summarize the findings of Rabbi Krishna in Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People, he basically says the bad things don't mean you're a bad person or that God is a bad God. He's just bad at being God because he can't stop the bad things. And I oversimplify, that's not the way he says it, but that's pretty much what he says in that book. God's a really, really good God. He's just not really good at being God. He can't stop these bad things, otherwise he would. These solutions don't do justice to three significant biblical assertions. Number one, the Bible asserts that no one is really good. So when bad things happen to good people, I don't grant the premise that there are good people. Technically speaking, nothing that happens to you is worse than you deserve. And secondly, Jesus was perfectly good, and he still got the highest dose of suffering. So being a good person doesn't negate you from suffering. Jesus was the only good person, and he suffered more than anyone. And thirdly, the suffering of Christ was predicted in great detail hundreds of years before he went through it, and yet God, who knew it was going to happen, orchestrated it that it would happen, purposefully. So the Bible offers a far more blunt explanation than Rabbi Krishna's. Bad things happen to good people because bad things happen to everyone in differing degrees because the world is cursed. That's the answer. Why do bad things happen to good people? Because bad things happen to everybody on this planet in varying degrees. There's no way to escape the bad things by being good. In Genesis 3:14 to 19, God cursed the world. He cursed the man, he cursed the woman, he cursed Satan, and he cursed the whole earth that we inhabit. Romans 8:22 says, "For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies." The whole universe is straining under this curse. It can barely bear the weight of the curse, including Christians who have the Holy Spirit in us. The Spirit in us makes us long for what we know is coming. Also, Satan is called the god of this world. In 2 Corinthians 4, verse 4, he's called the god of this world. In Job, we see Satan raging against one of the most righteous people ever to live, the one that God singled out as the most righteous person on the planet, Job. So God cursed the world so that, this is important, why did God curse the world? So that we would be miserable here. Adam and Eve fell, they became mortal. The day that you eat of the fruit, you shall surely die. Dying, you shall die. They became mortal for the first time. They were now going to die and spend an eternity where they belonged, which is away from God, unless God made a plan in his grace, which he did. Now, Adam and Eve knew God, and they knew to repent. They knew to restore with him. But what about the many, 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 many generations later? God allowed the world to decay into the curse so that people would realize this isn't where we belong. This isn't normal. This isn't right. We are made for something better. The fact that we know that things are wrong here shows that there's something in you that's hardwired for something better than this. And so he gave us tastes of joy so that we would know what we are missing here and we would long to be in heaven. And he gave us tastes of suffering so that we would hate it here and long to be with him in heaven, so that we would seek him out and find him. So in short, God made earth painful so that we would run to him for rescue from our pain, from our sorrow, from our mourning, from our grief, from our suffering. And when you go through real suffering, whether it's physical or emotional, the suffering of loss, whatever it is, when you go through that, there's something in you that just doesn't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be in a world where these things happen. I don't want to be in a world where these things happen to me. I don't want to be in a world where these things happen to someone else. And that's the exact right response. That's how bad the curse is. That nobody feels, you know what? Heaven is a place on earth. No, it's not. Heaven is so much better. And so one of the reasons that this happened to little Hadassah is because it happens to everybody. And yet, within that, there's grace. Within the curse, within the suffering, there's grace. There's traces of God's involvement in grace and protection. And we see these things. Why did bad things happen to Esther? Because bad things were busy happening to the Jews in captivity, and she was a Jew. So where's God when bad things befall his people? God was, you know, people say, well, where's God in the book of Esther? His name doesn't appear. It's the only book of the Bible where God's name doesn't appear anywhere in the book. No one talks about him. No one mentions him. No one references him. It's not even written in the book. Where is God in Esther? And my response is, look more closely. because he is there. So those are the effects of the painful curse that's kind of setting up the problem. But now we see the efforts of a protective custody. Look at verse 7. He, meaning Mordecai, this Jew who was also there in captivity, was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure. She was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Look at verse 8. Esther was also taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who had charge of the woman. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with cosmetics and a portion of food, the 7 chosen women from the king's palace. And he advanced her and her young woman to the best place in the harem. Look at verse 15. Now, Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. Look at verse 17. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight. So the point of chapter 1 was, this is how bad the world can be without God. This drunken debauchery. The point of chapter 2 is that little Hadassah was not God-forsaken. The point of chapter 2 is that this world is not without God. That even in the midst of her suffering, her being orphaned, her being in captivity, even in this being shuffled along like cattle to the slaughter into this man's lust, she was still being guarded by the Lord, being provided for by him. Just as she was being beautified externally, God was busy making beautiful in his time a wretched situation. And in every tragedy of Hadassah's hard life, there are traces, palpable traces of God's unmistakable protection and grace. For one thing, her life was preserved. Many people died in the deportation. Her family was preserved. Then her parents died, but she had a godly relative who protected her, who counseled her, who raised her. She didn't grow up fatherless. She grew up with Mordecai. Her purity is preserved. Many women fell victim to the rape during that deportation. And yet here, little Esther is preserved because we're told that she's a virgin. Her freedom is preserved. She's free to do what she wants within the limits of what everyone else was free to do. She was born with exceptional beauty in form and appearance, as well as a charming personality. She was not only Miss Photogenic, she was also Miss Congeniality. She received counsel and guidance from this cousin of hers. And in her conscription, she was favored by those in charge. She was favored even by the king. And she was promoted to be the most powerful woman in the whole country, really in the whole world, because the Medo-Persian Empire spanned the globe. So she goes from being an anonymous orphan girl to the queen of the world. Coincidence? I think not. I think God is obviously involved in all of this. And I call this scenario the efforts of protective custody. You know what protective custody is, right? It's when the police take you into custody, but not because you're a criminal, because they're protecting you from criminals. So sometimes witness protection, that's a type of protective custody, or when a woman whose boyfriends are beating them up, the police will come and take the woman away while they deal with the man and make sure that she's safe first. You know, that's protective custody. Even diplomats, when diplomats show up, there's security assigned to them to keep with them and keep them safe, protective custody. And we see this protective custody here. Although the curse is in full effect in Susa, as it is in Mobile, as it is everywhere else in the world, so is God's protective grace. God's protective grace was in full force in Susa, in the life of Hadassah. And nothing happens outside of his permissive will. We see this with Job. Remember, God limited what Satan could do to Job. Not touch his body, and then he could touch his body but not take his life. We see this with Joseph in slavery, but he gets promoted, he gets favored. And we even see this with Jesus. Remember, Jesus said this to Pilate. Pilate said, listen, I'm in charge. If you would just talk to me, I'll let you free. And in John 19:11, Jesus answered him, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. I'm in your custody, but I'm exactly where God wants me. Acts chapter 2, verse 23, this Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. What happened to Jesus was exactly what God wanted to happen. And so the most unjust suffering ever was endured by Jesus, and even that was known beforehand by the Trinity in eternity past in order to make all things beautiful at the right time. And the New Testament says this is always God's way of dealing with his people. Romans 8:28, for we know that for those who love God, all things work together for what? For good. For those who are called according to his purpose. What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? What about you? Have you been robbed? Have you been swindled? Have you been abused? Have you been betrayed? Are you sick? Are you injured? Are you maimed? Have you been poor? Have you been unemployed? Have you been bankrupt? Have you had a rough life, or have you had a rough year? Welcome to the curse. It really bites, doesn't it? And it bites and it stings in varying degrees in varying seasons of your life, but it's always there. But I'm sure if you use your eyes of faith, you can identify the traces of God's involvement even in your trial. And that's one of the wonderful things to talk to Christians who have gone through difficulty, loss of a loved one or a painful disease or some sort of protracted trial. Christians who have been imprisoned unjustly, persecuted. When you're talking to a mature believer about their trial, there's always elements of rejoicing. It can't be explained, but it's there. People rejoice. People talk about how God was gracious. I have a friend, a very good friend, who after a number of years battling various different cancers, said that cancer was the best thing that happened to her. Young lady. Because she said God taught her so much about how to minister to others, how to lean on his grace, how he provided through all of that, how he provided for her young children and her husband and all of these things. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, does it? Unless God is real and he's involved. So here, even in Esther, we see the effects of a painful curse, but we also see the effects of a protective custody within that pain. And finally, we see the effects of a planned course. And for this, I want us to cheat and skip ahead a couple of chapters to chapter 4. I want to give you a glimpse of forthcoming attractions. This happens after a sinister plot has been hatched to wipe out the Jews over the whole world. And we're going to get to that in some depth, but there's only one person in the world who's in a position to ask the king for an audience, to lodge the request, and to pass a law that can save the life of the Jews. And guess who it is? Our little orphan girl, Hadassah, who because of her beauty and because of the favor that God granted her and because of everything else that happened, she is now his queen. And this queen of Persia, she's a Jew. Nobody knows that. She's kind of waiting. She's saving that knowledge for a day. And then kind of like where Clark Kent takes off his glasses, rips open his shirt. You see the big S emblazoned on his chest and you realize it's not Clark Kent. That's Superman. That's what happens here. Hadassah's kind of like, actually, I'm a Jew. And everyone's like, didn't see that coming. And she uses this, and Mordecai gives her a pep talk of why she needs to go and do this. In chapter 4, verse 14. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish, and who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Mordecai has unshakable faith that the Jews will preserve because Mordecai knows the covenant of God. It's another time God isn't mentioned explicitly, but Mordecai's confidence comes from knowing that God promised that the Jews would never be wiped out, that there would always be a remnant, that they would preserve. And so he knows that the preservation of the Jews will come from somewhere because otherwise God lied and broke his covenant, and that's never going to happen. But he's telling her, you could be collateral damage in this genocide, you and your family. And you don't get to be part of it. But the reason you are where you are and you are who you are and the way you are is for such a time as this. And so he inspires Esther to take one for the team, risk her neck. And that's where she utters the inimitable words, well, if I perish, I perish. I always picture her saying it with like a Clint Eastwood voice. She's just got this like toughness. She's got true grit in there, and she's like, you're right. Yes, I could die, but if I die, so be it. If I perish, I perish. She's the right person at the right place at the right time. And with the eyes of faith, we can see God's efficacious plan all along. And all of this started, this is the end game that we kind of jumped ahead to a little bit, but all of this started because this little girl was pretty. I mean, who would have thought that just because she was a cute little girl, God made her that way because years later, that would result in her being able to save her nation? It could not have been predicted, but this is God's plan. God is working it out step by step by step, and he preserves the messianic line, and he safeguards our salvation. Isaiah 46, verse 11, God said, I have spoken, I will bring it to pass, I have purposed, and I will do it. In the same way, God has prepared and positioned and gifted and used Esther for his glory. Not that she can boast, but so that she can walk in the good works that he has prepared for her, in the language of Ephesians 2. The only question is, do you see your part in God's plan? Wherever you find yourself, whatever trial that you're in or have been in or have come through or are going into, you need to remember it's not because God's asleep at the wheel. He's in control. And the gifts that you've been given and the talents that you've been given and the relationships that you've been given, whatever he's given you for a purpose. And when you see the need and you realize that you've been equipped to meet the need, you have to realize that the reason God gave you that is for such a time as this. Maybe the church needs something and you have it. Maybe your local government needs something and you have it. Maybe your family has something, and it could be money and it could be a talent and it could be training. It could be encouragement. It could be time on your hands. Whatever it is, God gives us these things so that we can use them. And he gives them to us sometimes way, way in advance. Where a little kid picks up a violin, skip scene 30 years later, and he's leading worship for the Lord in a church. We never know what God's doing in our life. You know that my journey to seminary, which led to pastoral ministry, which led ultimately to me being a pastor in this church, started because I got fired. I didn't get fired. I mean, I got retrenched. I got let go, laid off with the school that I was teaching at. I was a high school teacher. And I was one of the people that got laid off. And I remember that day just kind of, I was a fairly new believer, but I knew I wanted to go to seminary and that I didn't really have the resources to do that. And now I had even fewer resources because I just lost my job. That was a bad day. I mean, if you've ever lost your job, that's not a good day unless you really hate your job. But I love my job. And I had no idea what I was going to do. But that started a chain reaction that led to me being here tonight. And I wouldn't have changed it for the world. But we don't always see it on the day that it happens. So anyway, in closing, do you know what happened with the 2002 Miss World pageant in Nigeria? Remember, they were protesting about a Muslim woman caught in adultery. That's what the protests were about, was the law in Nigeria that could put women to death for committing adultery. There was a particular woman whose case was in the news at the time, Amina Lawal. And Lawal, actually, Amina Lawal. Due in part to the courage of those contestants who were boycotting the Miss World pageant for the sake of this woman, the spotlight turned from them onto her case. And even though her case had been heard and she'd been ruled against and she had been sentenced to execution, because of these beauty queens refusing to go on with the pageant because of this lady, the journalists stopped writing about the pageant and they started writing about her. And the pressure from the Western media became so strong that her case, the appeal went through and her case was seen by a 5-judge panel that overturned the verdict. And her life was spared. She was released. All because of these beauty queens and what they did. Who would have thought that? A little girl wants to enter a beauty pageant, skip scene to years later where somebody's life is saved because of the decisions that were made that day. You'd have to acknowledge how politics and pageantry sometimes become linked, as they did in the Book of Esther. Coincidence? I think not.